You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for listening again this week. September is here, and for one Central team, that means the AL Central title will be clinched very shortly. We'll check in with Jeffrey Flanagan to see what's new with the Royals and their pennant push. The Twins are in a different sort of playoff push, still trying to do what would have been unthinkable at the beginning of the year and win a wild card spot. We'll talk to Rhett Bollinger about that. Big news in Cleveland this week with team president Mark Shapiro announcing that he's going to leave to take over the Blue Jays business and baseball operations. I'll sit down with Jordan Bastian to discuss that. And we'll hear from Jason Beck and Scott Merkin about the September call-up plans for the Tigers and White Sox. Away we go. Big news associated with the Royals this week is the pending return of Alex Gordon. As we record this, nothing is set in stone, although it sounds like he could be with the team as soon as Tuesday. What are your expectations for Gordon as far as basically how much we'll see him here down the stretch?
Well, I would expect he'll kind of start a little bit slow, maybe every other day. You know, he's been playing every day in the minors, but he's been kind of going back and forth from DH to the outfield. He thinks he's about 95% right now. No real reason to rush him. You got September call-ups. They right now are going to have a glut of outfielders. So I would expect maybe to start off with four times a week, maybe five. That way you can obviously move Ben Zobrist around and get him his at-bats. And then hopefully by the end of September, Alex Gordon will be at full strength and ready to go for October.
I guess you could call Gordon a September call-up in that sense, but any other plans as far as the roster expansion goes?
Yeah, I think Ned Yost has been actually waiting September 1st so he can get some extra bullpen help. They've got some tired arms down there. Ryan Madsen hasn't thrown for, I think, a week now, and Greg Holland's had some elbow issues. Wade Davis had some back issues. So Ned's anxious to get some more arms up here. We'll definitely see that. He indicated we weren't going to see a ton of moves made because he doesn't want to overburden his coaching staff with too many bodies, but we'll definitely see some pitchers. I will guess Terrence Gore will be a lock because of that weapon of his speed. And you might see a Christian Colon or Chester Cuthbert, a middle infielder, in case they want to give Alcides Escobar a day off. So you'll see some subtle moves to start off with and then probably more as September goes on.
Johnny Cueto gets the ball in Tuesday's opener versus Detroit. His last two outings, 12 earned runs over 11 innings, 21 hits. Opponents have a 1.162 OPS off him in those two starts. Obviously not the kind of performance the Royals traded for. Of course, they also traded for him at a point where it wasn't so much about what he delivers in the regular season so much as the postseason. So we'll see how that shakes out. But what have you made of it? It's only two starts, but just that it is in the stretch run here. What have you made of those two starts? How concerned?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some communication problems going on between him and Sal Perez behind the plate. Cueto's been shaking him off quite a bit, and especially in the last outing was against Baltimore, whom he never faced before. And one would think that would be a time where a pitcher would just kind of hand the reins over to the catcher and say, you put down the signs and I'll throw them. But there was definitely we weren't on the same page that night. He got lit up pretty hard. Really, the main problem was his cutter was just kind of going up there spinning. So they're kind of working on some things with his arm angle. No real concern right now, but you know if it stretches out to a third straight poor start, you know it's going to make people start scratching their heads a little bit. But he is an ace. You know he's allowed to have slumps just like everyone else, and so I think that's why there's not too much of a panic. And you know, he was brought on board to be the number one starter in October, so mainly just trying to get him in preparation for that. We've got a pretty comfortable lead in the division. Still a semi-comfortable lead for the best record in the AL. So they're just going to try to keep moving forward here down the stretch in September and get him ready and everybody else ready for the playoffs.
On the positive side, it seems like Cueto's had an impact on Yordano Ventura. I don't know if it's just some... Sometimes you hear stuff from a teammate and it's hammered home easier than if you hear it from a coach or what. But it seems like that relationship, as we kind of speculated when they traded for Cueto, it seems like it's been a positive.
Yeah, it really has. And actually, you can throw Edison Volquez into that mix too, because the three of them are almost inseparable in the clubhouse these days. They spend a lot of time talking baseball, and you see them in the dugout too, up on the railing steps. They're all huddled together and they're talking baseball all the time. And you know, I don't think it's any coincidence, and Ned Yost didn't think so either, that Giordano's best 4-game stretch of the season has been his last 4, as he learns a little bit more from Johnny. And you're right. I mean, sometimes you can hear something from a pitching coach, and Dave Island's a terrific pitching coach, but you can hear it over and over again from him, and it doesn't sink in quite as much as when a teammate says it. And that's probably what's going on with Giordano right now, but the Royals certainly are very pleased with his last 4 starts, and if that's the Johnny Cueto effect, that could be worth the trade, what they give up in the trade as well. So very encouraging from Giordano, and they hope to see that continue through September and October.
You talk about encouraging. The last 10 games or so from Mike Moustakas, you know, there are ebbs and flows of the season, but really it was kind of a large sample from the beginning of July to August 18th. Moustakas had a .183 batting average, a .292 on base percentage, a .313 slugging percentage. Obviously not numbers that align with what we saw from him, you know, for much of the first half. But to see him coming on strong here, again, this last week and a half or so, that's a very good sign for this offense.
Really is. And what you're seeing, too, is him starting to go back and driving the ball hard the other way. You mentioned that stretch in July and August. And we kind of noticed it, too. His spray charts were, he was going, he's pulling, he's really getting pull happy again. Now, it might have been the fact that the league adjusted to him and started hammering him inside, and it's kind of hard to inside out those swings. But we've seen a lot of balls hit rockets to the opposite side of the field for Moose. It went over the Green Monster at Fenway, and just a tremendous shot. And he's had 3 or 4 doubles to left field and left center. So when he's driving the ball the other way and using the whole field, he's a much more complete hitter. He's just been on a tear the last week and a half, 2 weeks, and they're very excited to have that back in the lineup.
Just a game and a half out of a wild card spot. Our colleague Phil Rogers had a column the other day basically saying that the Twins have shifted from a surprise to a legit contender. I'm wondering, as a guy who's in that clubhouse every day, how has that shift played out within that room? Is it something where it's been a growing belief as the season's gone on? Because there's certainly been some dark moments as the year has gone on. They've had some rough stretches. And I'm sure there had to be moments where even they were questioning if you know, this is definitely going to be a competitive situation going into September, but here we are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the big thing was that big month of May. They went 20-7. I think that's kind of when it started to turn heads there, both just in baseball and kind of nationally. I think the Twins players in general, some of those younger guys, they hadn't really been on a winning club before, started to kind of believe a little bit. You know, guys like Brian Dozier and Trevor Plouffe have been on for a little bit. You know, these are guys who really hadn't won with the Twins before, and all of a sudden now they're on a winning ball club. It's early in the year, but, you know, Torrey Hunter's having a good start to the year. He's kind of clubhouse leader, kind of a new change, all the dance parties and everything. They got off to a hot start. You're right, they've had some stretches here and there that kind of, you know, gone up and down since then, but that month kind of helped them. You know, since then, the months have also been kind of 500-ish, even a little below 500, because there's a big buffer from that month of May, they've been in contention. And you're right, the game and a half back, the Rangers are ahead of them. There's another team that was kind of a surprise team, I think, coming into the year. I think the Rangers, you know, especially with, you know, you, Darvish getting hurt and all these kind of things, people probably didn't think the Rangers won either. You know, to be right in it, heading into September, September call-ups coming up pretty soon here to kind of reinforce this team. They're right in the thick of it. And yeah, they are a team that's kind of in contention. I mean, you look at some of the numbers, though, obviously their run differential, you know, is negative. But at the same time, we've seen teams in the past, like the Orioles, do that in some of the playoffs. So it's really not a question, you know. So you never know. But right now, they're definitely in it, and I definitely believe that they're in it.
You mentioned the September call-ups. What's the focus there? What's the plan there? I know it would seem to me, at least, that some bullpen reinforcement would probably be priority number one, especially the starters have struggled to go deep into games here lately.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the big thing right now. I mean, I think 8 of the last 9 games, Twin starters have failed to even reach 6 innings until Irvin Santana finally had a good start there. I think definitely some bullpen arms, some guys we've seen this year, guys like Michael Tompkins had a really good year at AAA. Probably AJ Ocker, who was up here recently. You got to figure he'll be up here. The big wild card, what they're going to do with top prospect Jose Berrios. He's starting Monday night, and general manager Terry Ryan's going to be there to watch him. It could be his last start at AAA, and he could come up. But the thing is, right now, heading into the start, he's got about 155 innings or so. And last year, I think he threw about 140, and the Twins are trying to keep him roughly under 180. So even if he were to be called up to start, you know, depending on the innings he goes in the start tonight, you never know. You'd probably only get a couple starts out of him anyway. So the question is it worth adding him onto your 40-man roster just for a few starts? Obviously, you're in contention, and he's a very big prospect. But you never know how he'll fare because he is, you know, only 21 years old. He's a prospect. That's the big question. Is he going to come up? And if he does, will he come up in relief? But obviously, if you put him on the 40-man now, and then next year he's on the roster all year, all of a sudden now, you know, you have to pay him an extra year of arbitration. He becomes a free agent a year earlier. Whereas if they wait now and don't put him on the 40-man, put him on over the, you know, in the offseason and bring him up in May, all of a sudden now they have an extra year of control. They save money in arbitration. So the Twins claim that's not a factor, but, you know, you got to figure that as an organization, they certainly look at that. So I'm definitely very curious to see what they decide with Berrios. And to start with Ryan, there's going to be a big one for him.
Yeah, always sometimes the contention timetable speeds up on you and all rules go out the window. So that'll be an interesting business balance with the what's going on the field. But how about Ervin Santana on Sunday, Rhett? 7 scoreless innings, 10 strikeouts. And in light of his recent struggles, that had to be a huge start for him, sort of getting that monkey off his back.
Yeah, definitely a huge start. I watched him throw his bullpen after his start in Tampa, which is obviously a start where he only lasted 2 2/3 innings. Really struggled there, and I think he had an ERA above 9 in August before his latest start here. We finally turned it around. And I watched his bullpen session with Neil Allen. It's kind of one of those ones where he went back to the basics. He was throwing from behind the mound on the upslope, and he was throwing on the downslope. Doing all these weird drills. You kind of get his fastball command in there. Even Neil Allen is kind of standing real close to the plate, kind of getting in there, trying to get him to work his fastball inside a little bit better. I mean, sure enough, it worked. I mean, I think that start, he looked a lot better. He's commanding his fastball. That's been the big thing. If you look at his average velocity, his velocity is actually up from last. So it's not a thing where his velocity is down or his stuff is worse. His slider is just as sharp. His slider is actually the same thing, being thrown harder than it was last year. So big thing has just been fastball command, and finally he kind of got that under control and started to, you know, command the fastball a little bit against the Astros. We'll see, you know, you're hoping that he's going to build on it and see if he can continue this, but you never really know. Just because just this whole year has been so up and down. There's been other starts you've seen him be really good. Obviously, the start in Anaheim, he was great. The start in Oakland, he was very good. But then even in Kansas City, he was very good. But we've seen so many other starts where he's really struggled there. So, if it's a turning point, that'll be huge for this team because this is a guy they brought in on, you know, on a big deal here, 4 years and $55 million. They really counted it on. He talked about the suspension and all that, but this is a guy that's a stretcher, and if he can kind of get it going based on his track record, that'd be huge. So it's one start, but definitely a step in the right direction.
I'm joined by Jason Beck. Beck, man, we've talked about Justin Verlander has certainly made some strides since his return from injury, but the near no-hitter the other night, Chris Iannetta, of course, hitting a double on the chalk in the 9th inning that would have been Verlander's 3rd no-no, but, you know, the takeaway obviously is less, you know, what that would have meant for his legacy or history, for me at least, and more about what it means for him going forward. I mean, he's really re-emerged as the ace we all knew and loved, basically. 8 runs allowed on 33 hits over 52 innings, a 1.38 ERA in that stretch. As difficult as this has been for the Tigers this season, that's a huge step for them going forward because we obviously know this guy is the leader in the rotation going forward.
Yeah, it's as rough as this stretch has been, and looking at the numbers in August, they're ugly. The fact that you can look at Verlander this month is the month that Verlander became Verlander again, even if it's like a slightly different form of it, I think could be the biggest development of the year in terms of this team contending again. He's got that swagger. He's got that look about him. He's sustaining strength into the late innings. The fastball, while it's not 99 or 100, he's got that reverse splits, as I like to call it, to use a running term, where he can start out 93, 94, and then pick it up as the game goes on, to where by the 8th, 9th inning, he's up to 96, 97, not just when he wants it, but you know, as long as he wants to throw it, not just situational. He can pound the strike zone with those and just have hitters come hit it. And it seems like it's 96, unlike early in the year, it's 96, 97 with the type of deception, type of movement that it's making it hard for guys to hit. He's not just swinging it up there with no idea where it's going. He seems to be able to throw 96, 97 with control, and that's huge for him right now.
Yeah, you see that and you think, you know, he could live up to the terms of that contract, which is something that even a few months ago was hard to fathom. But great credit to Justin Verlander, obviously a great competitor in this game. And how about this guy, a competitor, 39-year-old Randy Wolf? I don't think he throws a 96, 97 back, at least, you know, to the naked eye. It doesn't look like it's getting in the net. He had a he retired the side against the Angels one inning last week, and not one pitch thrown that inning was harder than 77 miles an hour. Obviously getting it done with a lot of guile, 2.57 ERA in 14 innings. This is kind of a fun story here down the stretch.
Yeah. Somebody on Twitter told me it's almost like a real-life version of Billy Chappell, the Kevin Costner's character was a Tigers pitcher from the Love of the Game. It's like, I think Billy Chappell supposedly accomplished a little bit more, but also I think Kevin Costner might have been able to throw harder back then than Randy Wolf is right now with some of these breaking balls, although he got his fastball up around 90 miles an hour the other day, and it's a sneaky fastball if you're not looking for it. It's fascinating to watch this right now. It really is, and maybe it's just me. I don't know. Maybe most of Detroit doesn't care, but to me, it's almost like this interesting experiment brought on by absolute desperate necessity to find somebody to help fill some innings here. And quietly, it's working out where he's not just throwing innings, he's throwing effective innings. He's giving this team a chance to win, even though they can't score when he's out there. And he's showing that the soft-tossing pitchers that Detroit seemingly avoided for years, they can succeed here. He goes in there. He's not just an active participant. He's an architect of the game plan that he goes in against hitters with. So he knows how his stuff plays against certain hitters. He knows how to sequence it. And he's getting it done. And I think in this age where I think we're so fascinated with the next great young pitcher on the scene and what they're going to mean for the game and how they play the game forward, it's cool to see a guy like Randy Wolf disappear for basically a year, unless you were in Buffalo or following the International League circuit, basically reappears, and is throwing effectively against a lot of odds.
And I am joined by Jordan Besh, and we are here in the bowels of Progressive Field. You and I just walked out of the Mark Shapiro press conference. Obviously, that's the huge news. We had talked about this a bit last week, the possibility of him leaving for the presidency in Toronto. Not exactly a lateral move when you consider the resources. And you, of course, covered the Blue Jays. You know as well as anybody. This is not just a Toronto market, a Canadian market, a huge opportunity for Mark, but obviously a huge loss for the Indians.
I think it's, you know, as Mark just said, kind of he's ascended the ladder here and didn't really have anywhere else to go upward, so he was looking for a new, unique challenge, and obviously the Blue Jays, one of the hottest teams in baseball right now, present that challenge. And it's an interesting move because it's not just like going to another American city or going to a different country, and he's got a family with kids of school age and, you know, it's obviously a very unique set of circumstances, and it seems like from knowing Mark, and you can attest to this too, that he's always looking for that next challenge and that next thing to embrace. And I think the one thing he said, which feels very important from the Indians' perspective, is the fact that, you know, he's confident and comfortable with the leadership structure that they have in place, you know, with Chris Antonetti, guys like Mike Chernoff and Derek Falvey, assistant GMs, and guys on the player development side, that, you know, he's stepping away here, and it's not like there's a huge hole in the front office structure that's leaving that structure with potential collapse. So
yeah, and what's interesting also is, I mean, Terry Francona was very out in front of this a few days ago, where he said we all know he's got this opt-out clause, We've known that from the day he was hired. He had his opt-out clause tied to Shapiro and Antonetti, and he could exercise that at this point, even though he's under contract through 2018, I believe.
Yeah, with two team options.
With two team options beyond that. But he was very upfront that the relationship he has with Chris has grown to be equally strong, and basically he's not using that as leverage.
Right, and I think one thing from talking to Dolan, because we asked him, you know, would he be looking for a, you know, even internally for a new team president, and he said one of the reasons, you know, he's not is he doesn't feel like Antonetti will have kind of that whole of that voice, you know, which he had in Mark, you know, because he's relied so heavily on Francona since he's been here as sort of that other baseball mind to lean on and rely on. So, you know, Dolan said if Chris does feel like something is missing, they could look to get like a special advisor to the general manager, but, you know, specifically filling that team president role, you know, they don't feel the need to do that right now. They can divvy up the duties from other people within the front office, and then Antonetti can kind of proceed as he has been with relying on Francona, bouncing ideas off him, you know, when it comes to player moves and decisions and things like that. So, again, I think this is a situation where Shapiro leaving doesn't create the kind of hole it would have maybe even a few years ago.
Also notable in all this, this has been one of the more stable executive groups in professional sports, really. It's not, you know, Shapiro has been here 24 years. Antonetti, I don't know when I believe he came out in 1999, I want to say. So you're breaking up that group, but the Dolan ownership has definitely prioritized stability, and they've also prioritized, you know, letting people pursue whatever opportunities come their way. So here was a situation where the Blue Jays approach about Shapiro, and we saw last year when they were interested in Dan Duquette for this role, the compensation issue became a big deal. Here, the Indians let this guy, who's really the face of the organization from a business perspective, let him go with no compensation. I thought that was a high character move, but certainly an interesting one.
Yeah, and that probably meant a lot to the Blue Jays, I'm sure, because there wasn't running interference there. And you know, when we asked about the compensation, it's like Dolan seemed surprised. Right. Like it hadn't even occurred to him. I don't think he even knew right away what we were talking about. But so that was interesting. I think that does show kind of his character there. And, you know, Shapiro was pretty upfront that while the payroll, you know, did not play a role or a major role in this decision to go to Toronto, where he, you know, undoubtedly will have more resources, he did acknowledge that the biggest challenge he's faced here is the Major League Baseball structure and kind of the restraints that the Indians have been forced to work under, just given the market size, given the payroll, all that. So I thought it was important for him to acknowledge that, you know, that has been a challenge here, but he was quick to say, you know, that wasn't the motivator for him to go to Toronto.
Scott Merkin joins me, and Merk, Jeff Samardzija, I feel like every other podcast we talk about Jeff Samardzija, he's had that interesting a season. He's had some very good stretches, some very bad stretches. August was very rough for him. An ERA just south of 9, an 0-6 record in the month of August. Really inconsistent all year, but that was a particularly rough month for him. And then, really, the story of his season might be the first inning. A major league high 25 runs and 40 hits allowed in the first inning. I think I've asked you this before. I'm going to ask you again. What is up with the Shark?
Well, you know, it's interesting. People have surmised, if I could use that word, that after July, where he had a 2.27 ERA, and he wasn't traded, because let's face it, you know, the Sox have been kind of on the cusp of contending, maybe on the outskirts of the cusp of contending, and there was some school of thought that maybe, you know, he wanted, with free agency looming, wanted to be part of a team such as the Yankees or the Astros, who I know had interest, that were more firmly entrenched in the contention in the playoff picture. But, you know, I've known Samardzija a little bit now from the year, and he's a pretty intense competitor. And I could see where maybe one start, you maybe lose your focus a little bit or just off a little bit because you weren't sure what was going to happen. But he's too good of a pitcher and too strong of a competitor to let it bother him the whole month. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think it's just been a bad month where we've talked about this before, where it's, you know, location and kind of that one pitch, that big inning, you know, gets him where he gives up it's usually like a 2 or 3 run homer. And it goes from there. You know, that happened against Seattle. He had one quality start the entire month of the 6 starts, which is very unlike him. And
That was against the Angels when he won 1-0 also on a home run. Or, I'm sorry, he lost 1-0 on a home run, a solo home run. And talked more on that start. I think we talked about this last podcast, that he had his splitter working there. Didn't really address his pitches specifically this last time against Seattle, but just a forgettable month of August for him. You know, I know people are saying, angry Sox fans are kind of saying, well, he's cost himself money, he's cost himself this, but Justin Marge is going to be fine. You know, no one's going to be... Justin Marge has earned the free agency, and he's going to get paid, and I don't, you know, think that's an issue. I just think he's upset, he's disappointed because he's not pitching well right now, and that's all it is. You know, I mean, these guys, sometimes people think it's lip service, but they really do kind of live in the moment. You know, they don't worry about October when they're pitching in August and September. So I think that's what's bothering him more than anything else right now.
Yeah, I saw Robert Ventura had some remarks about, I mean, it basically sounds like it comes down to his pitches zigging when they should zag and zagging when they should zig. I mean, the cutter sinking and the sinker cutting and that sort of thing, just not getting the right movement at the right time, basically.
Yeah,
you guys go through those stretches.
Location, and,
yeah.
You know, it's disappointing for the Sox because he was kind of picked up as, you know, acquired for four pretty decent prospects. One, Marcus Semien. Well, three of the guys, Marcus Semien, Josh Fegley, and Chris Bassett, all are making, you know, significant contributions to the A's and probably would have helped the White Sox this year as well. But, you know, he was going to be kind of that 1-2 counterpunch with Sale, and, you know, Sale's kind of held up his end of the bargain, and Samardzija, you know, has, Samardzija really his only bad month is August. He's had some other months that weren't great, but, I mean, August was just really one to completely forget.
Well, August is over, or
yes,
at least by the time people listen to this, it will be. Merck, what's the plan for September call-ups? I know Eric Johnson is probably going to get a start, correct?
Yeah, I thought you were asking my plan. Right now I'm waiting to see how much it costs to get my car fixed, but that's not a problem for anyone but me, really. Yeah, I think...
And by the way, Mark, this would not be the first of these podcasts recorded from the mechanic, so I've done one as well, so no worries.
No, I'm actually at home waiting to hear from the mechanic.
Oh,
so,
okay. Oh, you're,
yeah,
oh, that's a dreaded problem.
It should be interesting. I'll update on the next podcast how much it actually ran me to fix it. But anyways, I digress. You know, I think the most interesting thing on the Sox call-ups is going to be who's not going to be included this year because of the fact that, you know, you just don't need to push them this year, and that's Tim Anderson and Carson Fulmer, who, according to MLB.com, are the 1-2 prospects of the White Sox. And Anderson very well could be ready in 16, might even, you know, force the issue at shortstop if they don't pick up Alexi's option out of spring training. If not, some point in 16, I expect to see him. And Carson Fulmer could be part of that rotation, much like Rodon, at some point early on in 16. But, you know, really there's no reason to push either of them. The guys who I figure will be called up are going to be guys who have, you know, pretty much been seen already by the White Sox. You got Frankie Montas, you know, hard thrower, probably work out of the bullpen. Eric Johnson has had a great comeback year for Charlotte after a dismal 14 season. It doesn't look like he's going to get a start in Minnesota, maybe not even in Kansas City, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him start at home against Cleveland or Oakland in that next homestand. Minnesota's in that homestand also. You know, a catcher, Rob Brantley or Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith is considered more, you know, potential to be a catcher of the future. Rob Brantley is a good left-handed bat, and they already have two right-handed catchers, so I would see him in there. Leory Garcia, who's been here, utility guy, and then Micah Johnson. So that those are the guys I'd look for to come up with to help the White Sox with September.
No Frankie Montas?
Yeah, I said right. Frankie Montas, he will be there too. I don't know if I didn't say him or not, but yeah, I don't think Frankie Montas will work out of the rotation much. I think you're going to see his 100-mile fastball coming out of the bullpen, maybe a spot start later in September when things are, you know, more official, whether they're completely out of it or, you know, still hang around the outskirts there. I think he'll get a start or two before the year's over, but I think Eric Johnson would be a guy who'd more consistently start for the White Sox
right
in September.